One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
We truly live in a global era, and certainly that's one of the key elements of globalization that comes across for the benefit of all humanity and so on. So we're very pleased in particular to actually welcome a new guest to the Midweek Drive today. She has had a fantastic career, born originally in Kenya. Of course, has also been Dean of Arts at the Hong Kong Baptist University, a founding fellow of the Hong Kong Academy for the Humanities, and of course, member of the board of the Danish Film Institute. Just generally an all-round Renaissance woman is Professor Mette Hjort. How are you, Professor?
I'm fine, thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
It's great to connect with you, good sir. Of course, you are head of the School of Film and Media. And our other guest, of course, today is somebody who remembers it when this was the School of English and Journalism, I think, Tessa. When, of course, we had Jason Whittaker in place there. You, of course, have graduated since then. Welcome to the programme. And how's life with you, Tessa, these days?
Hello. Well, it's lovely to be back because it's been a while, hasn't it? But yeah, busy, but very good. Thank you.
Well, I know that rather like our next guest, when we actually said it was the Professor Mette Hjort who was actually going to be on the programme, clearly he was very keen to actually be with us because he's a cinematic genius of his own routine. He has a whole stack of things in Hollywood, of course, Los Angeles. Phil Leonis, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. How are you, sir?
Oh, my goodness. I had to unmute some sort of speaker and I came in halfway through that introduction and naturally was very excited to learn who you were speaking about.
There we are. Well, we have, as I say, Professor Mette Hjort. Phil, would you like to open up the questions about her? It is her first show, and there's a whole stack of material that's actually there. So, Phil, take it away, please.
Well, I think for the benefit of those of us who are not on your fair shores, what is the status of education, in-person education, after this tumultuous time, especially when it comes to the arts and in-person is so important? What's the status right now?
Well, that's such a great question, Phil. Thank you for asking that. Maybe I'll just speak quite personally here. You know, I joined the University of Lincoln in June, and so I was communicating with colleagues from Hong Kong before my arrival. And one of the things that we were talking about was the challenge of engaging students. And I was hearing from, at that time, my future colleagues at the University of Lincoln that student engagement was a real big issue and that a lot of the students didn't seem to be connecting that well with their studies, with each other, with their tutors, and so on and so forth. And the marvelous thing has been that everyone I speak to now in the School of Film, Media, and Journalism is reporting to me really spontaneously about the wonderful situations that they are in with their students, the enthusiasm of the students, the corridors are buzzing, people are really, really switched on. So it's absolutely wonderful, actually, to see how, you know, students and also their teachers have longed to be in a situation where you're actually interacting face to face. And the whole dynamic is just so different. I had a very concrete experience of this myself because as the new head of school, I was welcoming all of the new students together with my colleagues. And, you know, the students were in the corridors ahead of time. They were eager to chat with us. And then we got into that large auditorium, which was absolutely packed, and people were not staring at their phones, and they were so tuned in. So it's been a really wonderful experience, I have to say, and tells us something about the hunger that people have for face to face.
Well, Mette, I've now known you for all of a minute and a half, and I already feel so good on behalf of these students that they have you to create this environment, because I can already tell that any environment you create, be it learning, artistic, work, is going to be a nurturing environment for people, and a safe place. This is what I always say to my acting students, and what I hopefully achieve on sets is a safe place to do the dangerous work of plumbing the depths of what it means to be human. And it's very easy to look back, of course, at what we've been through, what we are still going through all the time, because the sky is always falling somewhere, and say, what's wrong with this? And I've become very aware of two things that were very right about the process that we collectively went through called global pandemic. One was what you alluded to, I think, that elements like the humanities, like our shared cultural inheritance, like telling stories about what it means to be human, have gone from being what at some times felt like a luxury to becoming a necessity. And that's that opens up so many wonderful possibilities. The other way in which this worked for me personally was it really forced me to focus on a skill that I had already developed but didn't appreciate fully, which was my ability to read energy. And when it comes to working with actors, it's all about how I can assess their ability to open themselves to embodying fully the energy of the character they're playing and having that energy affected by the energy of often imaginary surroundings. And boy, working in this medium, the virtual medium, forces you to really drill into that if you're going to have anything to offer at all. And now when I'm face to face with people or in a collective of people, it feels, I wouldn't say easier, but it feels like putting on a comfortable jacket.
I so hear you. I so absolutely hear you. There's something about the face-to-face situation which precisely has to do, as you say, with the ability that we have to read others. And there is, you know, what I'm struck by time and again is how quickly we can resolve things, how quickly we can fine-tune things, how quickly we can build consensus, work through really challenging issues. And I'll just give you an example of this. We, you know, have just created this new school. And in connection with that, we've had, you know, a number of away days. And at the moment, we're, you know, asked by the university to come up with new programs, to think about phasing others out, and so on and so forth. In other words, you know, to talk about issues that involve things that touch people quite directly. And so we had our last away day, and we had a really, really vigorous conversation about all of these issues with people coming at them from lots of different angles. And but the thing about face to face is that you can take the temperature of the room, or you can, you know, read the face and realize, oh, we need to ask this person to pursue that line of thought, and so on and so forth. So being back in a face-to-face situation, it really does, as you say, it feels so comfortable and so good. And I think that, you know, just building on what you've said, I mean, there are a couple of things that I just wanted to sort of pick up on. The one is this business of risk. Risk is something that I've thought about a lot. I've published a book called Film and Risk, because it is something that I think is so important. And indeed, you know, as you say, I mean, creating the safe spaces, the nurturing spaces where people can take risks, I think it's all important, not only for, you know, the students, but also for the scholars and the researchers. And that's, you know, it's something about, I think, building trust, letting people know that it's okay to fail, that there is the concept of the interesting failure, and that, you know, people won't be penalized for taking risks in the event that those risks don't actually sort of, you know, end up bearing fruit. So that's one thing that I, you know, absolutely am on the same page on. And then, you know, the other thing of, you know, creating safe spaces, nurturing spaces, I think it's quite interesting because we were asked at the beginning of the semester to, you know, think about how we would improve our game, let's just put it very succinctly, in a certain area. And we basically agreed as a school that we would focus on one thing and one thing only, which was community building. And that was, you know, that's a term that you don't, you know, often find in the kind of meta discourse that gets generated in a university environment, which is, you know, can be about report writing and, you know, making promises and so on and so forth. So it's a very, very simple, very human term, build community. And we are, you know, quite far along with that. And we had some very concrete proposals in terms of how we were going to do this with our students. And it's just wonderful to see how just a very, very simple word like that, if you just focus intensely on it and get everybody to realize that, yes, we can actually, you know, we don't need to write reams. We just need to have some very clear ideas about why community matters, how one goes about building it, and so on and so forth. You can achieve so, so much. So I want to return the compliment. I think, you know, I've listened to you speak for all of 4 minutes.
I feel we've actually bridged the whole connection between Los Angeles and Lincoln via Hong Kong. Let's bring in Tessa Snart at this particular moment in time. Tessa, you've been listening to, obviously, Phil and Netta wax lyrical over the connection with the students, etc. I mean, share with us your experience, because you graduated how many years ago now?
Oh, my goodness. It was in 2018. So 5, 6 years. It was, yeah, quite a while ago. I can't actually believe it when I think about it. But, yeah, I mean, my experience at the university was great as a journalism student. You know, we were heavily involved in groups and teams and everything, especially in radio and television. So we was always very much encouraged to get involved and pair up and do this and that. And obviously Alex has been a great help in that when we joined the show, the Midweek Drive. So I personally had a great experience, but of course COVID didn't happen when I was at university. It was still face to face. I'm naturally quite a nervous, shy person, so actually it brought out the best in me. And now I feel like I can go up to anybody and talk to anyone and anything. So what you're trying to achieve and what you're bringing to the table sounds amazing for students of all kinds. It really is incredible.
And just share with us, Tessa, what you're actually involved with now, because it also has an educational edge to it, I believe.
Yeah, so I'm a podcast executive, but basically, in other words, I interview mortgage brokers for a living to create their content for their website. So it's all to do with SEO and marketing and everything. So that's really, really interesting. I never thought I'd ever be in a job role where I could do that, where I could use my voice or talk for a living. And obviously, I've learned a lot from the marketing side now as well. So that's, yeah. And again, without the course I did, without the help of you, Alex, I probably wouldn't be doing that role. So it's definitely helped.
Well, as Phil learners will confirm, Midweek Driveouts never actually quite leave. They kind of still stay on board in a whole range of ways.
Well, I've always been struck by how Alex's work as a teacher and as a host, the ways in which it dovetails, not exactly the same, but the ways in which there are parallels and overlaps. And there's something that you do that I've witnessed, if I may, that my favorite teachers, both the ones that I had and the ones that I revered reading about in any field, always, how do I put, John Wooden, the great UCLA basketball coach, once said that if he taught his players anything that did not have a real world application, he was failing them. His job, he said, was not to create champion basketball players, but people who would be champions at life. So it was always about life lessons. In his whole career, they only once ever game planned for a game. It was always about this art of building community, of ensemble, of finding what each person excelled at and building something beautiful with all those pieces. And lo and behold, he's the winningest coach in sports history. And I've always taken this into my work as a teacher with both actors and film students, hoping that I could be that good to make sure that what I'm teaching has real world applications. And I feel that that's always what Alex has done. And coming out of pandemic, I realize for the first time some of the skills that we are giving to people that actually do have real world applications. Who knew? Things like logistical planning. I always wondered when I was teaching my film students how to plot out the logistics of a scene, of a day, of a shoot. What real world application does this have? It's so specific to film. No, now I work with corporate clients all the time, and I'm confronted by the lack of logistical training that is in the world. And this is an incredibly valuable skill. But community building to me often comes back to something that, Mehdi, you were speaking to without using this word, intimacy. I feel that intimacy is our birthright. We expect our actors to form an intimate relationship with their characters. We hope those characters will form an intimate relationship with the audience. How can we expect this if we don't create an environment where intimacy is possible? Because again, intimacy can be very scary. It can be very messy. It's what's required for shy people like Tessa to be able to find their authentic voice and realize once you have found your authentic voice, you are at home in any circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, clearly I need to actually introduce some basketball into the histories of journalism classes as and when they
resume. Oh, do I need to explain? Do I need to explain for your audience on your shore what basketball is?
I think they're okay. I think they pretty much got it from the notion of NBA and various other aspects. Mehta, I noticed that you're also co-chair of the Hong Kong Baptist University's Ethical and Theoretical AI Lab. Now, obviously, artificial intelligence is something which very much springs to mind in terms of my science fiction interests and so on and so forth. Do you think we're getting to the stage whereby basically virtual Phil Learness and virtual Alex Lefchuk will effectively be sort of, you know, used as a sort of hologram to actually engage in our usual sort of midweek drive repartee?
If so, please make me look younger.
Thank you for that question. There's quite a long answer to give there. I'll try not to ramble. The context, I do think I need to evoke the context. The context was that the chief executive of Hong Kong staked out this area of art and technology as an area that she really wanted the city to excel in. And that promise was, of course, also then made vis-a-vis Xi Jinping, because he, of course, is a very key player in that part of the world. And so that created incredible opportunities for the government-funded universities in Hong Kong. Suddenly there were, you know, quite remarkable resources available for initiatives that had to do with art and technology. And I think that, so that'd be the first thing I'd say. Then the second thing I'd say is that that particular lab was established because we saw a real need in that part of the world to focus on ethical issues as they relate to AI. And then I guess the third thing I would say, that's actually an anecdote. Coming back again to COVID, one of my dear friends and a colleague at Hong Kong Baptist University, the composer Eugene Berman, originally from Russia, then in the United States, was in New York for a while, Estonian background and so on and so forth, has a new opera of his opening in London in February, Russia Today. So Eugene had this wonderful project that was going to involve bringing a bunch of Danish singers over to Hong Kong. And then COVID intervened. And so rather than shutting down the entire project, he ended up precisely working with holograms. And I will never forget it. So we were in the Hong Kong park, and it was, you know, this kind of a peripatetic experience of the work. So we were walking around Hong Kong park, and then there was a waterfall in Hong Kong park, and these holograms of the Danish singers were projected against the water. And then you looked through them and you looked through the water and you saw the skyline in the background. And it was just absolutely spectacular. And I think it was kind of a turning point in Hong Kong, because Eugene had shown us how to do something really, really interesting in that area. And then I will just take it one step further. At a certain point, more recently, Eugene was contacted by the Gulbenkian Foundation in Portugal, with and he'd worked with the foundation previously, and they said, you know, this is how he tells the story. They said, do something for us. You decide what you want to do. And so Eugene, reflecting on how COVID had impacted the cultural sector, said, well, I want to do something that basically evokes just how difficult it was for cultural practitioners to survive, to continue to remain committed to their craft and so on and so forth during the pandemic. And so he composed new music, was performed there at that wonderful, wonderful venue in Lisbon. He had basically holograms evoking the absent performers on stage as we listened to his music. So I think it's an area that is really, really fascinating and is definitely, definitely you know, part of our future, and we need to embrace that. At the same time, I think it's really, really important that we enter into that space ready to have really probing conversations about what is worthwhile, what is worth doing, where the problems are, and so on and so forth. So I feel very fortunate because my conversations to date have been with people like Eugene or with the new media artist, Jeffrey Shaw, who's also a colleague of mine at BU. And then to bring things into the Lincoln context, of course, you know, wonderful colleagues like James Field, who's doing such interesting work in the area of virtual production. And we've got colleagues who are very proficient in immersive technologies and so on and so forth. So I think it's a really, really, I think the future is exciting, but it's also an invitation to have some really, really careful, considered conversations so that we don't, you know, forget about, you know, the humanity of things and what it takes to build real community and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
We clearly must put you in touch with our good friend, the executive director of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, Ben Cadwallader, who also talked us through a number of key things that the LA Chamber Orchestra are also involved with over the COVID period, etc. Phil?
Well, I just was wondering, and I open this up for anybody's feeling about this, but sometimes I think a la what I always appreciated about Shakespeare, about how Shakespeare would take me very far from my here and now and yet bring me closer to some truth that affected my daily life. And I wonder if this conversation about venturing into the world of AI that forces us to have conversations about humanity is needed because seemingly so many of the conversations, the thorny conversations we do have, lack humanity. So it's almost like we need to venture into
the virtual realm. Phil, you said you wouldn't mention about timetabling on the program. We had to step away from timetabling, honestly, you know?
I don't even know what that means.
No,
it sounds like a horrifying euphemism.
Like something
the American government did at Guantanamo Bay. They timetabled that guy.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, exactly. So
I just made a torture joke. That was not cool. Anyway, no humanity there whatsoever. But I am struck by so often, where is the humanity? Where is the humanity in these conversations we have? You know, everything, again, during the pandemic, seeing almost riots over mask mandates and thinking, I understand nobody wants to be told what to do. And why should I feel that my elected official knows better than I how to keep my family and loved ones safe? I understand that response, but I don't understand going out and getting so angry about it, because where's the humanity in that? Where, you know, I might have a reaction against it, but my humanity tells me, but if this makes other people feel safe, why don't I want to do that? Mm-hmm. And so, again, long story long, I'm wondering if that's the wonderful opportunity here as we venture into these realms that can be so scary and so thorny. if forcing us to have the conversation about what it means to be human is because we've abrogated that conversation in so many other avenues.
I can really relate to that. And at one point in Hong Kong, we had the opportunity to collaborate with the Consul General of France and Macau in bringing the French artist to Hong Kong called Yves Joly. And Yves Joly brought with him a series of photographs that focused on social robotics and particularly the use of robots in care homes. And then we built a whole conversation around his work and brought in a scholar from Japan, where, of course, you know, robots in care homes are very, very prevalent. And Paul Dumichel has written a wonderful, wonderful book on social robotics. But this was an incredibly moving experience to have the possibility of learning about Eve's experiences with robots in dementia settings and, you know, care homes, hospitals, and so on. And exactly, you know, as you say, I mean, his photographs capture that encounter between the machine and the person, and we learn so much about what it means to be a person by looking at what the person projects onto the machine or needs from the machine, and so on and so forth. So I can really follow you there, and I too feel like, you know, so many of the you know, official conversations, I mean, there's a lot of cynicism, there's a lot of there are too many layers oftentimes, there's not enough transparency. And then, of course, a lot of the official conversations are also caught up with AI, but not in an intelligent way, at which, you know, oftentimes I think we're experiencing artificial stupidity because a lot of the systems don't actually work very well.
Superficial intelligence rather than artificial intelligence.
Whatever term there's a need for something to be the counterpoint to artificial intelligence, because a lot of us are grappling with systems that don't actually work, and they're accompanied by discourses that don't have, you know, the features that we associate with humanity, community, etc., etc. I can really follow you there, and I think, you know, for me, what I've noticed is that there is a great opportunity for artists, for clear-headed, clear-minded artists who have a strong sense of purpose, a great sense of integrity, to sort of move into that space and do really, really important work, and to kind of help us to have those conversations. And so for me, somebody like Yves Joly, with, you know, his extraordinary series of photos, and then the accompanying film, L'Age du Robot, I think is the title, The Age of Robots, which is doing really, really well on the festival circuit. You know, he's a good example of somebody who helps us see what machines can teach us about being human.
To use the classic line from The Tempest, we are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little self is rounded with a sleep. Just to the bard actually doing his piece there. Tessa, anything you'd like to sort of add to the session at present? Because obviously it seems like only yesterday you were scoring a first-class dissertation with your analysis of the future of the music industry and how musicians were actually using their own social media channels and so on.
I find it all so, so fascinating, but I agree with what you were both saying there as well. But I guess if you take climate change and things like that, if you look at artists, if they can become holograms and tour without actually having to go on tour, again, I know it takes a kind of that humanity, it takes that human effect away a little bit. But maybe, you know, if little doses of it, maybe that could be a good thing, and that could really help people. And even, I mean, take the ABBA experience tour, that's happening, isn't it? And their holograms, and everybody's loving that. I've heard great things about that. So I suppose from that point of view, it's quite beneficial. But I suppose there's always pros and cons, isn't there? And I suppose until we explore it further, we don't really know to the extent of what that can do or that could be. I do find it a fascinating topic, though. I guess I'd be more of it.
Phil, we actually spoke, I think, a year or so back, where you said that when you actually were doing a residency, I think it was at UCLA, there was a discussion then about how classes could be delivered offline in any case, and that kind of offline aspect was very much on the agenda.
Yes, going back several years now. I mean, this was probably 7-8 years ago. That was the movement. As they continue to build ever more buildings, because that money is earmarked for buildings and can't be used for anything else. Nope, no way to crack that nut accounting-wise. And yet, the plan is not to populate those buildings with classes because, oh my goodness, who's going to pay for the air conditioning? Who's going to pay for, you know, all the other costs? We'll just build buildings that someday will be lovely ruins. And we might have a professor in there giving a lecture, but it will be all virtually delivered. We don't want students in the classrooms on most bases. This was 8 years ago, and I was part of, based on work I had done designing media for the university before, I was brought in to consult on this. So good memory, Alex Levchuk. Sometimes your AI just is sharp as a tack.
Well, it is important, Phil, to obviously maintain that line of things. Anyway, actually,
I was thinking of an opportunity that I would love to see, apropos of what Tessa was saying, technology to afford us, because we as human beings so often meet the thing with the thing. Someone gets angry at us, we get angry at them. Something speeds up our ability to get something done, we speed up along with it. And there is such an opportunity, it strikes me, that as technology allows for greater speed, greater distance, to be many places at once, that maybe the human being can move slower. As I get older, I find that when I am traveling someplace, whether it local, whether it overseas, I always try to take the slowest possible mode of transportation I can, so that I can experience the journey along the way. And so, Tessa, I think it's not necessarily the holograms taking the place of the artists, but in some way expanding the scope so that we can maybe get back to our footprint, literally being a footprint, where we walk instead of running, where we take caravans instead of supersonic jet planes. That would be my dream. It enables us to slow down and with it form some deeper relationships with the places we go.
And as you know, Phil, I'm always keen to actually ensure that I embrace my own inner hoodie, because ultimately it sort of just demonstrates that clearly we're there, we can actually go through all sorts of wonderful things and celebrate the joy of life and so on.
How do we know that's not you? Yes, I have met you in person, but that was more than a decade ago. This could be you now, Alex.
It's a strange and bizarre thing, but it has brought us neatly around to actually the last two questions that we need to ask. And Phil, technically, you're a head boy on this one. I mean, it would normally be Tessa, but Phil, would you like to put the first of those last two questions to Professor Mette Hjort, please?
Professor, have you enjoyed what I understand is your inaugural electronic link with us here on the Midweek Draft?
I have absolutely loved it. It's and I'm Meta. No need for all this professor stuff.
Well, I had led with your first name at the beginning, and I realized I should at least now follow up with you have not worked as hard as you have to be referred to by your first name exclusively this program.
It's been wonderful meeting you. I've loved the conversation. It's been just a delight.
Does that mean that we can look forward to connecting with you again in the near future?
I would love that. I absolutely would love that.
And hopefully, Meta, actually in person in the studio for at least two of us.
That would be great. Yeah.
On the Midweek Drive Live. Tessa, has it been good for you?
Oh, it's been marvellous. I've really enjoyed it. I've loved meeting you, Mette, and I've loved seeing you again. It's been a while. And you, Alex. It's been a while.
I hope we get to learn from Tessa in the near future again how she's transforming the mortgage broker business through the art of podcasting.
Into human beings. Mortgage brokers into human beings. That's a challenge.
I did not say that.
It's you were thinking it though, Phil. I could sense you were thinking it. It was coming across. The sensitivity was actually there. So Tessa, I take it you'll return before too long.
I would love to, yes. Thank you.
And Phil, before we actually head into three interviews back to back on Road Safety Week and the importance of actually changing your tyres for winter, well, it is the midweek drive after all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer yourself ahead of Thanksgiving?
This was wonderful. It's am I coming back before Thanksgiving?
I think so.
This was wonderful. I appreciate so much being invited to participate in this. And I can't tell you how much it has just filled me.
And just in case Meta wishes to actually check out your latest awesome narrative, which is out, of course, available through most good channels now, would you like to give a little plug for the Lady Killers? That's the Lady Killers.
I was wondering which one you were talking about, because gosh knows I have so many people breathing down my neck for projects that I was supposed to have already delivered. Yes, my most recently completed feature film, The Lady Killers. What am I supposed to plug? It's a dark comedy.
That'll do fine.
about a game of exploitation gone wrong.
Obviously prefiguring the joys or perhaps the stresses and strains of Mr. Weinstein, but that's another line entirely.
Oh, absolutely. Some people thought that one of our characters was clearly based on Harvey Weinstein. It predates the Me Too movement, but clearly it was in the zeitgeist. And, and I used this form to try to get people to explore the ways that exploitation in its many forms leads to violence. And in much of my work, if I can find a way to laugh about that, then at the very least, I will be an easier person to get along with, if not a more interesting storyteller.
Phil Leonis, director extraordinaire, and of course, producer Tessa Leanne Start, and of course, Professor Matthew Hjort, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And we will connect via Zoom in the not too distant future.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, the output from COP27 will continue to resonate, but you may find it fascinating to realize that if you were an average UK motorist who left their car running for 244 minutes each winter, which is approximately a little over 4 hours, you would be generating a combined total of 107,000 tons of CO2 annually, which is more than the entire population of Cardiff flying to Egypt for COP27. I know, it's mind-blowing. So let's talk a little bit more about this interesting fact, and indeed why warming our cars in the winter is not necessarily something we should necessarily be looking towards by actually talking to the wonderful Farouk Yacoub, a member of the IET's council and, of course, electric vehicle expert. How are you, Farouk?
Yeah, I'm doing really well, thanks. How about yourself?
Yeah, good. I mean, again, interesting, of course, in terms of some of the findings of this survey that the Institution of Engineering and Technology, or IET, have actually carried out, that over half of motorists who are planning to buy an electric vehicle in the next 2 years are now delaying because of finance concerns. I think the suggestion that the budget will also see road tax being applied to electric vehicles as well is something else that is probably putting people off the notion of, well, should we go electric? Is it going to be as much of a saving as we were once led to believe it might have been?
Yeah, definitely. I know there's a lot of concerns out there with the budgets. Obviously, there's an important announcement due to come out imminently. But in the meantime, I understand that there will be significant concerns with the cost of switching to an electric vehicle. But what you can do in the meantime is understand that winter idling in your combustion engine vehicle, so your petrol or diesel vehicle, you can actually reduce this. A lot of people don't know that all you need to do is ensure that your engine is lubricated, and this takes your car less than 30 seconds from when you start it. So there isn't actually a need to idle for extended periods of time.
which again is something which I think from an engineering point of view, I think there's a traditional notion that, oh, well, you've just got to allow it time to warm up, etc. Presumably the same thing with respect to windows and such like. I mean, just use some de-icer would actually help from that point of view. Or is that also bad for the environment?
So it can be bad for the environment. There are products out there which use alternative ingredients, but using de-icer in the grand scheme of things is better for you, because you're reducing the amount of time you're idling to defrost your windscreen. So it's a means to clear your windscreen, so it's safe for you to drive, and it just takes a lot less time when you're using de-icer or a scraper or something of the sort.
We know that clearly 2030 is the year that's hailed as the final end of producing new petrol and or diesel vehicles from that point of view. Cars still very much seem to be to the fore here. Do you think that there's going to be a smooth transition to electric vehicles, or is it still going to be a case of, well, you know, we still don't know quite how things are going to pan out? There's been an initial uptake, but will that continue?
Yeah, so definitely. So if you look in vehicle sales, you'll notice that a lot of people moved into hybrid vehicles, which have a combined electric drivetrain and a combustion engine. So it's got some sort of petrol or diesel, and at the same time you have your battery powered portion of the vehicle. And then a lot of people are also early adopters using electric vehicles, and as you can see from all of the OEMs out there, so the vehicle manufacturers, they're all investing in electric vehicle technology. So it won't be long before the infrastructure is widespread and easily available. At the moment, you can take a journey on the motorway and have superchargers at a service station and carry on. You can travel the length of the UK. But that will only increase in availability, and the transition to EV will be easier and easier as time goes on, including cost coming down for those vehicle parts.
I was going to mention that, of course, because as we do transition over to electric vehicles and so on, we've talked about some of the concerns about finances, etc. It was also intriguing to find that 71% of drivers questioned said that they were more likely to make the switch to electric if government grants were reinstated. Again, with the cost of living crisis, I suspect that's not likely to occur. But is it sometimes important that central government will take a steer on this to incentivize people actually switching to electric vehicles?
Yeah, so the IET are actually proactively trying to engage the government in providing incentives for people to switch to electric vehicles. So the IET does consider it to be an important piece to the puzzle and point which could help motorists switch over to electric vehicles. So they're taking it quite seriously.
And in terms of finding out further details, Farouk, about this particular survey and indeed the importance of not leaving your car just simply idling over the winter months to warm up.
Yeah, definitely. If you can head over to the IET social channels, so that's at the IET. If you just Google at the IET, you'll find all of the relevant information.
Fantastic. Farouk Yacoub, member of the IET, that's the Institution of Engineering and Technology Council, and of course, electric vehicle expert. Huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.
Now, as we currently seem to be enduring a fairly mild November, you might well have thought, oh, what the hey, winter readiness for one's car, don't need to worry about that at all. But as conditions can change overnight, literally, we need to be well aware of the best way to prepare our cars. Astoundingly, there are a number of people who actually say we don't really need to bother with respect to our tyres. Well, we do. And to actually explain why tyres are so vital and important to our whole driving safety and experience, we're delighted to welcome our leadership team member from Audi UK, James Allett. How are you, James?
I'm very good, thank you, Alex. How are you doing?
Good. Now, Audi, of course, in Germany is a place where they're well aware of winter weather and they will obviously have winter tyres, etc. We don't do this in Britain. Why not?
Firstly, Germany, along with many other countries on in the European mainland, it's a legal requirement. So once the temperature drops below 7°C, you are legally required to fit winter tyres onto your vehicle. So that is not currently the law in the UK. But whilst you said it's quite warm weather at the moment, colder weather is definitely around the corner. And for a good chunk of the year, we are below 7°C in the UK also. So Audi and the charity Brake, who we are working with, are championing road safety this week. And we believe it's important to inform the drivers of the benefits of winter tyres and to reassure them that it's never been easier to fit them.
As you say, it is Road Safety Week, and we're covering a number of aspects with respect to that. But 61% of people actually surveyed say they had no plans to fit winter tyres this year. That's pretty high, almost two-thirds. What are the benefits, in essence, of actually ensuring you do change to winter tyres in terms of, obviously, your car performance and safety?
Anything below 7°C, from when the temperature hits that below 7°C, that's when it's much more beneficial to have winter tyres on than it is summer tyres. So it's about having the right rubber on the road for the right time of year. Summer tyres are made of a different rubber compound, and when it hits that temperature and drops below 7°, the rubber hardens, whereas winter tyres are made of a special compound of rubber, which is softer and can grip the road better, and has more grooves in the tyre as well, which help that grip. And the ultimate thing here is that winter tyres ensure braking distances are reduced by 5 to 10 metres, and that's potentially the equivalent of 3 car lengths when driving as fast as 60 miles an hour on the road.
And to the people who would actually say, well, okay, we've got winter tyres on last year, so I've just left them on over the summer, why shouldn't they actually keep their tyres on year in, year out?
It's a little bit, Alex, like wearing flip-flops in winter. They're great in summer. They're absolutely the right footwear for those warm summer days. But you wouldn't necessarily wear them in winter. They're not necessarily appropriate. They're grip levels and comfort. And the same the other way around. You wouldn't necessarily want to wear thick winter boots in those hot summer months. So it's the same with tyres, having the right tyre on the vehicle for the right time of year. And essentially what we want to do is at Audi is make that as convenient as possible. So many of our centres will offer what we call tyre hotels. So you can come in, you can store your summer tyres over the winter, and you can store your winter tyres over the summer, and we'll fit those winter tyres for you as well.
And again, it goes without saying, you should really go to an approved dealer to effectively get your tyres fully fitted, unless you're a qualified person yourself. I mean, changing your tyre might seem simple, but perhaps it's best to get the whole thing sorted out by an approved dealer.
For sure. Audi spends billions in developing our vehicles. It's a shame that the thing that attaches it to the road isn't put on in the right way. So we'd always recommend that they go to an official Audi centre to get that done.
Inevitably, James, there always seems to be in Britain at least a sense of shock when that frozen water starts beginning to fall and conditions get a little bit problematic. What general advice would you actually give to somebody who might be listening to this, say, in November, and they're thinking, oh, well, I'll just put that off until maybe mid-December?
I suppose, is it worth the risk? I would always say that the weather can change at this time of year very, very fast. It's all about being prepared. Like I said, there are many instances where the car tells you what's wrong with conditions and what's going on. But in this instance, getting those winter tyres on for November, mid-November, I think would be a really, really sensible thing to do, and therefore meaning you have the safest tyres on the road.
And for further information from Audi UK, where would you actually point them, James?
To our website, audi.co.uk. Simple as that.
James Allett, leadership team member from Audi UK. Huge thanks and happy driving.
Thanks, Alex.
I think it was Blondie who had a hit back in the 1980s with "Accidents Never Happen in a Perfect World." And maybe they don't, but certainly we have to minimise the risk of accidents, especially when you're actually driving. And if you don't know the highway code, then maybe you're not doing your best to minimise your chance of an accident. Shockingly, more than a third of the 40 million drivers in the UK have said they would accept a call whilst driving, with 9% replying to emails, which is staggering. And to actually talk us through some of the other findings from this particular survey, we're pleased to actually welcome to the program Senior Associate Lawyer at Slater and Gordon. That's Nick Hadjisava. How are you, Nicholas?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Excellent. So, I mean, I just couldn't believe this particular set of findings, because surely, I mean, we know the highway code has actually changed. We know we need to be more aware of pedestrians and so on. But things like using mobile phones and eating and doing your makeup whilst being behind the wheel, it's insane, isn't it?
It's quite a shocking set of results, isn't it? The one that stood out for me, even though it was quite a low percentage by comparison to the others, was 9% of people admitting to replying to emails, which amongst all of the other shocking findings, I think for me stood out, because you'd have expected that to take a bit more of a bit of a thought process when your ultimate concentration should be on the road. So that was quite a staggering result for me. It's, as you say, that, you know, everyone's aware of the highway code in principle, but how much we are aware of on a day-to-day basis in terms of the specific rules we're supposed to be adhering to on the road is quite surprising when you see how many people are willing to take what are perceived to be small risks, but can have ultimately some devastating results.
Yeah, very much so. Now, clearly, the highway code itself changed a year or so ago, and again, to great acclaim. I think most folk, we should be aware that pedestrians are now at the top of the hierarchy of road users. Just actually talk us through, again, that hierarchy of road users, and indeed, it's not necessarily giving pedestrians the rights to literally just walk out whenever they wish, but certainly they do take sort of precedence when it comes to road incidents, presumably.
Absolutely. And the whole purpose of the change to the highway code in terms of the hierarchy is to really recognise the vulnerability of road users as a collective. And it's for that reason why pedestrians are at the top of the list, because ultimately a pedestrian who is impacted by another road user is highly likely to become off worse off. Second to them are cyclists and then motorcyclists, for the same reasons that ultimately they are more likely to be seriously affected by any incidents on the roads. And naturally, as you would expect, the least vulnerable will be the users of vans and heavy goods vehicles, who are at the bottom end of the scale of priority, but naturally that is for pretty obvious reasons. And you talked about it's fair to say that pedestrians can't just decide that they own the road, and it's not meant to provide that ultimate priority for them. But there are certain examples where pedestrians are in a more prioritized position than they were, that some road users, drivers, for example, may not be aware of. So if a driver, for example, is turning left from one road into another at a junction, and a pedestrian is crossing the road, that pedestrian has right of way. Whereas historically, you might have thought as a driver that as you're approaching a left turn, for example, that you would have the priority by taking that turn. But we must all, as road users, as vehicle users, be very aware of the priority that pedestrians now have over vehicular users.
And as with all laws, people can obviously disagree with them if they wish, but the fact that they are actually in law means that they are actually legally enforceable from that point of view. I mean, my general sort of feeling is that we still have a hesitancy, and I think that's backed up by this survey, to realise that when you are actually driving, you've actually got, on average, about 1.5 to 2 tonnes of lethal killing device at your control, basically, in terms of the car itself. So it is important, presumably, to actually not just think once, but think twice, and indeed 3 times when you're driving about, obviously, other incidences, other hazards and other challenges that you might find whilst driving.
Exactly. And it's for that reason that, you know, we are talking today at the start of Road Safety Week, and the whole premise of Road Safety Week is to highlight the fact that we want safe roads for all. And this isn't a way of trying to sort of play on drivers for being the cause of a lot of incidents. It's more to recognise the things that we can all do individually that will add to a greater level of collective responsibility on the road. And if everyone takes a bit of notice and improves their own driving behaviours to a small extent, That will increase everyone's safety on the roads, and it will stop incidents occurring, which we always describe, they are avoidable incidents because they are occurring because of lapses in what we should be doing on the road, as you say, when we are ultimately operating a dangerous vehicle.
Do you feel that as automated vehicles and driverless cars are gradually rolled out, that's going to improve the situation, or could it actually lead to even more legal confusions?
You'd like to think in theory that as technology improves and driverless technology becomes more and more widely available and widely used, that there will be a greater level of safety inbuilt. I know there have been examples where there are incidents even with driverless cars. So there is still a balance to be struck, and the law needs to adapt to include provision for those types of vehicles and any incidents that they may be involved. But I still, while the vast majority of people will be road users, even as technology catches up, I think it only strengthens the belief that we all need to pay a bit more attention to what we're doing to improve our own responsibility, and that will increase the collective responsibility and looking out for everybody who's vulnerable on the roads.
Yeah, very much so. Now, if people wish to actually find further information about the survey, or indeed to brush up on the highway code, whatever their stage of driving happens to be, whether they're new drivers or whether they're more experienced drivers, where would you actually suggest they should go?
The best place to start for the highway code is the gov.uk website, because it breaks everything down. It tells everyone what the rules are, what the guidance is, what the responsibilities are. And if anyone needs to be reminded, it also tells what the implications can be. So, you know, people may be surprised to hear that, if you're caught using a phone on the road, which may seem innocuous to people, but as we've been talking about, can lead to catastrophic results, then you may find that you get 6 points on your license, a £200 fine, which is strange that people would take that sort of risk for something as innocuous as picking up your phone to change a song in your music streaming service or things like that. And you mentioned new drivers. If you are caught using your phone, you can lose your license if you've only passed your test within the last 2 years. And then you've got the whole rigmarole of having to get a new provisional license and retaking both of your tests. And once you balance that all up in the equation, you sort of wonder whether it's really worth it to have those moments of inattention on the road for innocuous reasons, when there are ways built into the rules for you to do things safely. So if you find a safe space to pull over, you can stop, take whatever call you need to, and then continue on your journey. The 2-3 minutes that it may be is just not worth that risk to yourself and the risk to others of that inattention.
Nicholas Haji Sava, Senior Associate, a lawyer at Slater & Gordon. Happy Road Safety Week.
Thank you, Alex, and happy Road Safety Week to everyone.